listening to The Finalysis with Travis Wingfield and Kevin Dern. Brought to you by WelcomeToPerfectville.com. Prepare to go deep.
A win is a win is a win, and despite allowing Colin Kaepernick to pass for three scores, 296 yards, and add an additional 113 on the ground, the Dolphins' defense tightened in the critical moment to pick up their sixth consecutive victory. What is happening, Dolphins? Travis Wingfield along with you here as always, and I am joined again by my esteemed co-host, resident defensive coordinator of Perfectville, Kevin Dern. Kevin, what is up, man?
Oh, the Tom Brenneman call is awesome, but the fact that it's Tom Brenneman just makes me cringe. But it's six in a row. Huge game. Probably the biggest game we've had in what, 8 years, not counting that 2013 end of the season. I'm psyched, man. Let's go on to Baltimore.
Well, I'm glad you called Tom Brenneman because I got to give the credit to him and Fox for that call. And I mentioned that you were a Reds fan living in Cincinnati. So you get to hear Brenneman every single night on your local Reds broadcast there. But you've kind of got me believing more and more that the sports commentating, my theory is that sports commentating is a massive nepotism conspiracy, and that anyone that has a child is automatically given a job in the broadcasting booth.
It seems that way. There's so many connections, you know, family ties in it. But I mean, Tom, he's at least a nice guy. I've gotten to meet him once. He's really nice. And obviously, his dad's a Hall of Famer, so I can't knock him too bad.
Well, there you go.
Just because I'm a Reds fan.
That works for everybody. So, yeah, I'm with you on that. The Mariners broadcaster, I'm a big Seattle Mariners fan. He's awful as well. But we're not here to talk about baseball or broadcasters. We're here to talk about the Dolphins. And for the first time tonight on the Finalysis podcast, your host, me, Travis Wingfield, is drinking a beer because I just feel like it. Because this team is playing so well right now, and I usually don't drink on weeknights. Save it for the weekends, but I needed a beer tonight, and I'm enjoying a nice Deschutes Brewery up here in Oregon, or in the Northwest, and it's an Oregon brewery, and I'm drinking that as I record here, so let's get right into it, man. I start talking about kind of how things went for you on Sunday. I watched the game as I normally do by myself. I try to kind of stay to myself when I watch the games, and tucked away in my man cave, and, you know, I was watching it, and that opening drive sequence with the Niners went down, I just was kind of bummed out. And the Dolphins score, and I was like, okay, cool, you were supposed to do that. So it took me about until the second touchdown to really start getting excited. And then they kind of gave it back towards the end. And it was elation at the end because, you know, that game had to be won. But it was also a sigh of relief. How did you feel about that final sequence there, or just the course of the entire game?
Well, I guess I should start off by saying all the ceiling fans in my house are safe. No incidents this week.
For 2 weeks straight now.
Yeah, 2 weeks straight. So I've got that streak going, much like the Dolphins have their own streak going. I agree. I mean, it was kind of frustrating to see San Francisco score early, but then, you know, Miami really kind of took control, and then they got the interception to start the second half. Got up 31-14, and I kind of thought it was going to be one of those games where, you know, maybe Miami scored, you know, another touchdown and got to coast, and, you know, those two three-and-out drives really kind of bit them in the ass at the end. But, you know, like you said at the beginning, a win is a win is a win. And, you know, what a play by Sue to stop him. And Alonzo got some, you know, Cuban revolution on Colin Kaepernick there at the goal line.
I heard the guys on the Perfectville podcast nickname him the Cuban Missile Crisis. I thought that was pretty awesome. Don't forget to check those guys out, by the way. The Welcome to Perfectville podcast. They are the original podcast of Welcome to Perfectville with Sam Marcoux and Chris Cullen. They do two shows a week typically, and then we're sandwiching between their two shows. They're great guys, really funny, good football knowledge there as well. So don't forget to check them out. I just did the AFC East Bros again about an hour ago, and kind of talked a little bit about some of the things we were talking about with Ndamukong Suh and making that play at the end. And I said kind of one of the most impressive things about that is the fact that this guy's out there playing 80-85% of the snaps, and down in that South Florida heat, he's chasing those guys down from behind, chasing down Colin Kaepernick from behind. I mean, what can you say about that guy's conditioning? It's just so impressive. This guy's, he's proven to be worth every dollar we spent on him so far, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, people kind of gave him a lot of flack early on because he does his conditioning thing up at the Nike headquarters in Oregon or whatever it is he does up there. But I mean, if he's out there playing 85% of the snaps and making plays like that, you know, let the man do whatever he's doing because it's clearly working.
And what,
you know, that was an awesome play.
Whether he's out here for the conditioning or for the Deschutes beer that I mentioned earlier, we'll leave him alone for that because he's getting the job done. But we'll get to that later. We've got plenty of stuff to get to for you guys tonight. We usually like to start this portion of the podcast by talking about kind of the respect level the Dolphins are getting in the national media. And this wouldn't be a segment if it wasn't for all the wins we've been compiling. But I just, you know, I love going over all the national media shows and just kind of seeing what they say, even though these guys are national, so they don't really watch the Dolphins games that much. They just kind of comment based on, you know, box scores and what they've seen on the SportsCenter highlights. But they did mention us on PTI. They mentioned us on Around the Horn. I was a little puzzled by the power rankings on ESPN and NFL. And Yahoo had us behind Pittsburgh and Buffalo, two teams with one less win than us, and we beat them head-to-head. So I'm not really sure how they came up with that. But we are at least starting to be talked about on Twitter today. Everywhere they're talking about Adam Gase and how he's just turned this team around. And Kevin just texted me before we came on the show to tell me about an article written. I can't remember the name of the author that wrote the article on NFL.com, but it mentioned how Adam Gase, I thought this was the coolest part about the article. Adam Gase is out at a bar in Miami back in January when he just got hired. And I don't know if he's hanging out by himself or what he's doing, but how cool is that an NFL coach can just go to a bar and he's not even recognized? And there's a rapper, and I don't know anything about rap, but some particular South Florida rapper, maybe Kevin can help me out after I'm done talking here, but he was talking about how Adam Gase will fail because of Ryan Tannehill, and a random patron at the end of the bar said, nah, Tannehill and Gase will both be fine, and the guy that actually said that was Adam Gase. So this guy's out there just a normal Joe hanging out with everybody, but he happens to be one of the best coaches in the NFL at the moment.
Yeah, it's Luther Campbell from Two Live Crew. So if you ever watched the 30 for 30 on the U, he's all over that. He's at like every picture of the Hurricanes players from the 80s at the bar. So that's who Gase was getting into it with. And that's pretty legendary already if you're doing that, not even a month into the job.
And that's one of my favorite 30 for 30, so it's pretty embarrassing I didn't know that. I'm a rock and roll type of guy, so I'm very lost when it comes to the rap game. But I know Trick Daddy likes to sing about the Dolphins, and he remixed the Dolphins fight song. Both are terrible, so we'll leave those alone. So Adam Gase, man, this legend is just continuing to grow. At 1-4, we hear these players talk about how there was a process that he was implementing, how the culture was changing even when they were 1-4. But the guy is just, he's something different than we haven't been used to. And we lost Don Shula in, was it 1997, was Jimmy Johnson's first year, I believe. So that would mark 20 years ago that we, you know, were without Don Shula. And Jimmy Johnson was, he was a good coach, let's not, you know, get that twisted, but he kind of handed this franchise off to Dave Wannstedt and left us in, you know, disarray for the next 15 years. And whether or not all that's his fault, it's probably not the case. But he put us in this spot to begin with. And so it's been 20 years, two decades since we've had a coach that I mean, don't get me wrong, I got a little bit fanboyed over Sperano's first year, and I thought Cam Cameron had a good offensive concept, but he didn't have the skill set to be a head coach. Little did I not know that then. But Adam Gase just checks all the boxes for a coach. I mean, he's, like I said earlier, he's changing the culture. The legend is growing. I can't wait to see where this guy takes us. I feel, for the first time in so long, that we have a championship-caliber culture and organization being built here from the bottom up, Kevin.
Yeah, I agree. I think Gase is definitely the right hire. At least all signs this year seem to point to that. I think really we'll get a better sense of just how good he is next year when he's got a full, you know, off-season process, a full draft class, a full free agency class under his belt. Because, I mean, if you're being honest about it, he kind of came in, you know, when those evaluations are kind of halfway done because, you know, the previous coaching staff is working on that stuff. So, but yeah, I'm excited to see what he does, and, you know, he certainly got the team clicking, and, you know, I think it was what, only he, Nick Saban, and Don Shula have had a 6-game win streak in the franchise's history.
That's pretty crazy, and the last time they had 7 games, which we'll get to in the Baltimore preview coming up later in the show, but the last time they won 7 games in a row was 1985, and yours truly was 2 years away from being born at that point, so I have not seen something that the Dolphins could possibly accomplish on Sunday. Enough of that. That's later for the show. Kevin, if you don't have anything else to add, I'm going to get into my offensive review for Sunday against the Niners.
Let's do it.
Sounds good, man. So I went ahead and looked at the film this morning at work. Again, I like to, you know, use company time to make my Dolphins podcast make it happen.
I hope your boss doesn't listen to this for your sake.
he's a typical 12 Seattle Seahawks fans, the 12s up here. We call him 2012s because that's when they all arrived. So I don't even think he would know how to download a podcast. So I think we're good to go. Rick, if you're listening, what's up, man? So let's talk about the Dolphins offense a little bit. And it kind of starts with Adam Gase and just kind of the plan. I'll give you guys a review of what the offensive game plan was here. They came out the same as they typically do. They try to run the ball and try to establish Jay Ajayi, despite having, you know, Sam Young, Craig Urbick, and Anthony Steen up there. And the Niners were not having any of that. The first three plays, they had 8, 9, and 8-man boxes. So, yeah, they're sneaking both their safeties into the box and playing just two corners on the edges there. But with the Dolphins' heavy sets, they can afford to do that. So they're crowding the line of scrimmage. And the Dolphins pretty quickly were privy to that and said, all right, we're going to have to beat this team through the air. Even on passing downs, they were jamming up on the edges with some cover one, cover three, and cover four looks. And if you guys don't know what that is, cover one's where a safety drops down the middle of the field and kind of takes center field. Cover three is where there's three areas up deep in the middle of the field and the corners that is covered. And cover four is where the corners drop straight back and there's two safeties middle of the field covering all four deep areas of the field. So they were getting up, getting deep in coverage and kind of pressuring the line of scrimmage up front. Like I said, they were throwing everything different at the Dolphins, and Gase just had an answer for it all. He was, you know, that play action rollback throwback is a staple of their offense, and it's working because Tannehill's legs are he's such an athletic quarterback, and our strong run game with that misdirection really gets teams off balance, and they can't match our speed at the quarterback position. Also, another thing I love was that fake dive toss sweep to Jay Ajayi. If you look at the play on tape, the two edge defenders totally collapse down inside, peeking inside. It's more of my Bobby Fischer comment I've been making about Adam Gase, how he ran that play in San Diego for a touchdown with the dive up the middle, and the outside guys collapsed on Ajayi. So I'm sure the Niners had that film in mind, and they collapsed on Williams, and Ajayi had the corner, so that was beautifully done. And then another thing that I noticed they've been doing, and I've mentioned this in the last couple of podcasts, was they do these twin stack formations where they have two receivers on either side of the formation, so four receivers, and they stack them, and it almost always is an inside zone play when they do that. They try to get the box numbers in their favor, you know, unblocked man, and Jai tries to make a miss, and it didn't work so much this game, but they took some shots even against cover four, which is pretty tough to do. That zone read play they ran wasn't working so well. Tannehill had one nice run on it, but other than that, it wasn't really working. They struggled with our guys in man coverage, and they rarely blitzed. I think they were pretty scared of our receivers' ability to win one-on-one matchups because they didn't really blitz that often. They helped the pass pro with some maximum protection on pass pro. And, you know, when we attacked the intermediate level of the field on those fake zone read play action misdirections that I mentioned earlier, Tannehill's just so deadly that it's hard to match his speed and his arm talent once he gets on the outside. And then the last note I had here about that was, just how they went ultra conservative on the last two drives. We'll get to that a little bit later, like you mentioned. But they really play to not lose, and that's kind of going against everything Adam Gase stands for. So,
what was your take on that? At least in terms of play calling, like I can't remember the exact play sequences in my head, but I think we only called one pass out of those six plays.
With 7.5 minutes to go, they got the ball up by 10, and the first down play was a run that didn't go for much, and then they ran a little swing route where. Excuse me, that beer's making a comeback, excuse me. They ran a little swing route to Jarvis Landry where he kind of runs a fade from the slot, and they try to get him on a jump ball, and it falls incomplete, and that was a contested catch that I think if you're going to, you know, for all the crap we get to see about running bad screen plays, if you're going to run a screen, there's a good time to do it because that way at least if it doesn't work, you still catch the ball and it keeps the clock moving. So those seconds could have been, you know, crucial had Kaepernick got into the end zone on that last play. So wasn't a fan of that. They had a nice pass play on that sequence as well where Jarvis Landry dropped a pass. So it's hard to get on Adam Gase for the play calling, but that's a catch that Landry is a tough catch, but you got to make that. Parker made two catches that were very similar to that last week, and Tannehill put it on the money again. So, you just can't have that from your number one receiver. And speaking of Tannehill, as we get into him a little bit here, in the first half, I had him missing just one play where he had Devontae Parker open for a quick slant as the Niners had 10 guys on the line of scrimmage with cover one deep safety. But besides that, he was perfect. He took a sack on that play, but his location on a couple of those balls in that first half were perfect. The one on the bomb where Devontae Parker sprawled out over the beautifully painted throwback Miami Dolphins logo at midfield and made a diving catch. That throw, it was a little bit too far, but he threw it away from the defender and gave his guy a chance to make a play, and Parker did make that play. And then the throw to the pylon, the trajectory on that ball, it's it's hard to explain. It's kind of like almost zip but touch at the same time, because he kind of threw it with a down arcing angle, but it had to have a little bit of heat on it to get to that back shoulder. So just a great throw there. I thought he looked very comfortable on some of the three-step drops. I think that was probably a function of the play calling because of our offensive line and the situation that we're dealing with there. He looked very good in those setups. He was going through his progressions very well, holding safeties with his eyes, snapping his head back to the other side of the formation and making the throw. He did have that one nice run I mentioned earlier. He gains 5 extra yards on that run just by not sliding and getting bounced forward. But I still would like to see him slide more because, we can't afford to lose this guy. But regardless, it was a hell of an effort and a really good play. The very next play, they ran zone read again, and he should have handed it off to, I think it was Kenyon Drake back there, but he didn't do it. On the touchdown to Deion Sims, he split 4 Niners up the seam. There was actually a box worth of Niners, and he put it right, where the tight end could get it, no one else. And I thought he made the pass protection look better than it really was on Sunday. He escaped the pocket so much. He climbed it and then would escape left or right. And I saw someone on defense.com today mention how they were worried because he only escapes to the right, but I didn't see that at all. He rolled to the left a few times, including that play to Devontae Parker that got called back on the 40-yard pass that he came down out of bounds. So another great day for Tannehill.
Well, speaking of his feet, just with the last two games when they've been missing Albert and Tunsil and Pouncey, have you noticed them doing more 3- and 5-step drops instead of some of these 7-step drops or these boot, play action fakes? I know they did one on the first play with Gray, but have you noticed that the last couple games?
Yeah, you mentioned that that rollout they do. That's kind of a staple of the offense. They started the game with it. They had a 2nd and 1 later in the game that they completed for a 1st down to Marquise Gray. But yeah, the 3-step drops are something I haven't really seen from them. They usually do the quick passing game out of the shotgun, and the under the center stuff is more play action where they attack vertically. But he has some 3-step drops where he sets up and throws off the 3-step from under center. And it's kind of awkward looking because you're not used to it because they don't run it very often. But this game, it did appear new to me. And then the 5-step drops has kind of been a staple as well. So that's been going back further. But the 3-step drop was pretty much brand new to me. I don't know. Did you get that sense at all? Or
I was just kind of curious because I thought I noticed it a couple times on some of those quick plays that they have. And maybe not so much the 49ers game, but I think they had a quick slant in the Rams game off of a 3-step drop. So I was just curious about that. And then the other thing I wanted to ask you was, at least from any Dolphins game I've watched with Tannehill, I thought that game against the 49ers was probably the best he's ever thrown the ball. He was just throwing lasers. I mean, he had the best spiral I've ever seen. I thought it was consistent throughout the whole game. Usually there's 2 or 3, ducks in there. But, what do you think about that?
Yeah, you're spot on with that. And, the dime to Kenny Stills kind of highlighted that throwing highlight reel, if you will, because that ball's right on the back shoulder. It's thrown with a great deal of zip, but it's in the cover. It's into a cover 2 bracket, so you have to put it in a right spot. And it takes such a precise throw, and he put it right there on the back shoulder so Stills could spin out of the tackle. And the safety mid took a bad angle. Antoine Bethea took a horrible angle. But, hey, you got to capitalize on those mistakes. The Dolphins did. It was a big touchdown. Kind of put the game away at the moment, but then obviously the Niners crawled back in. I had another couple negative notes on him from the second half. After that big Kenyon Drake return, he made a poor decision on a 3-step drop that no one was open on. He kind of tried to force it in and could have been picked off, or at least take a sack, or throw it away or take a sack. I mean, it was just a poor decision. There was another play where he had a blitz come right in the an A-gap blitz come up there, and Jay Ajayi got over to chip him, but it didn't really afford him that much time, and he instantly, bolted to the right and got around the corner for a 10-yard gain. Another great throw on the run he made was to that, like I mentioned earlier, was that sideline throw to Landry. It was a deep comeback route right to the stick. And it was a perfect throw, low and away, for the receiver to go down, dig it out, and Landry couldn't make the catch. So for me, that was 3 mistakes in the entire game. He checks the box emphatically for me. I don't think I have to ask you what your thing is or whether or not you give him the check mark or not. Now, this is clearly his team now. I think he's taking over that role. I'll let you have the final word on him because I just can't say enough about how impressive he was on Sunday.
Yeah, if we were allowed to give him double check marks, that's what he would get from me. And I thought that was one of the best games of his career. And I think he carried that momentum from the Rams game, those final 2 drives into the game against San Francisco. His best game of the season, and hopefully he keeps it up this week against the Ravens.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the 6th game now. We've been checking the boxes for him. I think that puts me at 4.5 and you at 4. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
So, and, you know, we're really going to find out what he's made of here the last 5 weeks, because these next five games, there's some pretty tough defenses in there, and particularly the defensive lines where we have struggled in the past on the road, no less. So we will see about that. That's for another day. Next was the running backs. You know, Jay Ajayi had barely anything to work with, really. He missed one cutback lane I saw. He showed great power on an early run where he gained 5 yards after the Niners kind of collapsed the middle of the field, and he powered through it for about 5 yards and should have been a loss. I think he's looking better as a receiver. He's starting to catch some more balls, and he's not really having that drunk guy from a – or stolen TV drunk guy from a party that you mentioned about Ryan Tannehill, where he kind of gets gangly out there and slips and falls. So he's looking a little more balanced on that. And then on that touchdown run I mentioned earlier, he had such good speed to the pylon and good awareness to get to the angle – or get to the pylon just in time, and he stretched it out as far as he could before he turned it up to make the Niner defender go as far as he possibly could have gone. So that was a nice run. They like to scheme unblocked guys, and I think that's kind of most every run offense in the NFL or football in general, and he's got to make a miss. I thought he kind of pressed a little bit and tried to look for the big run rather than just getting the tough yards, but that's kind of understandable. I mean, there wasn't much room for him there, so not Jay Ajayi's best game, but he also didn't have much to work with. Damian Williams had that nice 5 yard run on a 3rd and 1 where Tannehill almost dropped the snap, and that was all him because the muff snap and then the offensive line push was just not there. And he pressed it hard for five yards and got that big first down. He was a decoy on that touchdown run that I mentioned, and he had a screen pass later in the game where he kind of danced around, and I didn't care for that because I thought he had a chance to get to the edge and get a first down, but he did not do it. Kenyon Drake, I'm starting to see this guy more and more. He's got that burst and the ability to get compact in the hole while maintaining that speed. He made a guy miss on his one run in the backfield and got 9 yards out of it. And then his vision on that kickoff return to hit the hole and not lose any speed was pretty incredible. So running backs were so-so for the day.
Yeah, I was impressed with Drake on that run. And, you know, I kind of feel like we're going to see him some more on offense down the stretch.
I really think so, too. I think they need him, too, because when Ajayi can't get it going inside, they need to kind of get a little bit change of flavor back there. I think that Kenyon Drake offers that for you because Damian Williams has a set certain type of play and plays that he can run that I think you're going to see more going forward the same, and I think Kenyon Drake is the one that sees the expanded role in terms of the running backs. For receivers, Devontae Parker, you know, I thought it was a great game, and it would have been statistically if the two catches that got overturned held up, but after watching on tape, it was kind of more of the same what I used to see with his inability to separate on at the top of his route where he does, 90-degree cuts or vertical cuts, whatever you would call them. The first catch on the deep ball was obviously fantastic, and the catch at the pylon in the end zone was another great catch. I thought they probably should have upheld that because I've seen so many bad replay challenges where they just kind of maintain the call on the field because they can't see exactly what happened. So whether or not that was a good call, I don't know. I thought they should have given it to him. He does have that game-breaking skill. You know, we really need that in the offense. But he does have a hard time breaking man coverage, man. And the Niners challenged him a lot, and he couldn't really get off it most of the day. He had the worst day doing that of the three receivers, I thought. So he does work back to the ball very nicely on broken plays, as we saw on the 40-yard catch where he got hurt. And I think he should be fine for the game on Sunday. I hope he is. We really need him. And then Jarvis Landry, not a lot of production there, but he's such an emotional leader. First guy to congratulate the guys when they make a big play. He makes other guys step up. He beat press on a 3rd and 11 and ran a great route for a 17-yard gain, but he had that big drop that killed us late in the game. Almost killed us, I should say. Kenny Stills, I talked today on the forum to some guys about how Kenny Stills continues to do things that don't really show up in the box score, but he runs these little search routes where he kind of sees the zone coverage and sees where the other routes are developing, and he goes and finds a hole, and Tannehill has a comfort with him there. And I think Adam Gase really likes that intelligence and that kind of savvy that Kenny Stills offers, so it'd be hard to imagine Adam Gase being a big proponent of letting Kenny Stills walk, even though we have Leonte Carew waiting in the wings, who made a great catch and run on Sunday for a touchdown.
I'm kind of in agreement with that. I feel like at this point, maybe bringing Stills back is the right call.
I think you can probably do it for cheap because the production's not been huge, so they probably won't get a big contract offer elsewhere. Maybe he will. I don't know. I hope we bring him back. But he sets up routes all game. You know, he had a quiet first half. If you look at the touchdown throw that he caught from Tannehill on that cover two for that big touchdown pass. If you look at it on film, he's raising his hand and Tannehill kind of gives him one of those nods that you see with Peyton Manning and Marvin Harrison. So I thought that was kind of cool to see because you don't often see the Dolphins making those quick adjustments there. And he saw the coverage being in his favor. And he knew he could beat that press on the outside and he got by it. Great balance to catch it and spin upfield, like I mentioned earlier. So good game for Kenny Stills. Offensive line wasn't great, but it wasn't terrible either. I thought pass protection was good throughout most of the game. Sam Young had one great combo block where he hit his guy and then got upfield for an additional block on an outside zone play. I had him for two missed assignments in the running game, and then two other plays where he was just destroyed. But his pass protection was pretty good. Craig Urbick, not really any big notes one way or the other. Steady performance, played pretty well. I thought him and Anthony Steen handled the stunts pretty well. And Anthony Steen himself played a pretty good game, actually. Had some digouts. He made some good protection calls, getting the guys lined up in the right spots. And he had an open lane on Ajayi's biggest run of the day where he just cleared it out for him. He got pushed back once where penetration was his fault, caused a big negative run. But Anthony Steen and Craig Urbick, I thought, played their best games of the year on Sunday.
I had a question for you about Steen. You know, just in the games that Pouncey's been out, and even going back to the beginning of the year when Pouncey missed, what was it, the first four games?
Yeah.
What's your sense on, like, Steen just kind of being the communicator and designating the blocking assignments? Like, do you think he does it as well as Pouncey? Like, it doesn't seem like, you know, other than the Billy Turner, Dallas Thomas game, there haven't been just like stunts and twists just coming right at Tannehill. You know, do you think he's done a good job, average job, below average?
I would say he's done above average because at first it was a problem. The first few games it was a problem, but the Niners tried a couple of stunts in this game and it went nowhere. And guys were passing off their assignments pretty well, and it looked pretty clean and pretty effortless from the Dolphins offensive line. So I think he's getting better. And that kind of brings me to my next point, to where, you know, we talked about this earlier on episodes of past, but I think Anthony Steen should probably take over right guard once Mike Pouncey gets back, because Jermon Bushrod, man, it is getting ugly for him out there. This is four games in a row where I just can't fathom watching. It's not Dallas Thomas bad, but it's pretty bad, man. It's a tire fire out there. He had three horrendous run blocking plays where he's just walked back into the backfield and kind of connects with Ajayi, making a negative run. He got called for a hold, and he had two sacks allowed in pass protection. The only two sacks were on him, I thought. So not a good game for Jermon Bushrod. Hasn't put a good game together for a while. There is talk about him having a shoulder issue that's causing him pain, but, you know, if you can't play, man, get off the field. So that's how I feel about him. Juwan James, another pretty steady game from Juwan James, I thought. I think he's getting a lot better. He's been great in pass protection. Not much negative to talk about the running game. It wasn't great either, so... just the offensive line as a whole was good in pass protection, running game not so much. And then that gets us to our tight ends lastly here before I throw it over to you, Kevin, for the defense. Deion Sims was horrible in pass protection and in the run game, which is so weird because that's usually his forte and where he makes money for this team. But he became a factor in the passing game. He did a lot of these little chips on defensive ends or outside linebackers or whoever was coming off the edge, and they would leak out into the flat and make a catch. And he had that one run where he just kind of said, get off me, and got upfield for about 20 yards. So he ran with the ball very well. That seam route and the touchdown catch he made was a good job of getting the ball into his body and securing the catch and coming down with it in the end zone. Very nicely done there. He needs to be utilized more in the passing game, I think, because he's effective when he is. I kind of talked about him earlier in the year, but he looked pretty good on Sunday in that aspect. But worst run blocking game I've seen him have so far. He was just dreadful in the run.
I gotta jump in here and defend him a little bit, because I think I had him on the keep list back when we did the keep unsure cut episode. But I thought, you know, at least the run blocks I saw that he had that he struggled with were against Ahmad Brooks. And Ahmad Brooks has been a pretty good player in the league for a long time. And just one quick story about him. He was actually taken by the Bengals in the supplemental draft back when I worked for the Munoz Foundation as an intern in college. And we got to go down to the Bengals training camp at Georgetown College, and we got to go on the field, and we were standing next to the linebacker drills. Brooks had come in the league as a linebacker for Cincinnati, and they did this drill where they take, you know, like the one dummy sled, and you basically hit it and then ripper, you know, swim underneath of it or whatever. Ahmad Brooks took that thing and literally threw it straight up in the air, and it flipped back over on itself. That dude is just a freak of nature, you know, strong athlete. So, you know, I know Sims struggled, but, you know, I think he'll do a little bit better this week against the Ravens outside backers.
Yeah, if you ever have your child stuck under a burning car, call Ahmad Brooks to flip it off of him, because that upper body strength is pretty ridiculous. And, you know, it's like you mentioned, these guys get paid too. It's not like the Dolphins are the only ones out there getting paid. So you got to give credit where credit is due. I just, he needs to get better. If Ahmad Brooks is a guy he can't handle, that's fine. But he does need to get better moving forward. But I'm with you on that all the way. Marquise Gray, not his best run blocking day, I didn't think, but not much else to say. He didn't get very many snaps. We'll get to that later. And Dominic Jones, in his limited time, had a phenomenal seal block as a split wide receiver on the Jay Ajayi touchdown run. So as a whole, it's hard to complain about this offense scoring 31 points. You're going to win most games when you score that much, but they should have been well into the 40s, I thought, Kevin. The sequence after the Drake kickoff return was just dreadful, going backward and ending up punting after starting nearly in the red zone. Stills not coming back to the ball on a comeback route cost them 4 points. I think it was after the turnover. He ran a comeback route to the corner, to the pylon in the front corner of the end zone, and he didn't come back to the ball enough because it was a well-located pass, but it got broken up because he allowed the defender to get to it. And then they went ultra-conservative late in the game, and despite doing whatever they wanted to throughout most of the game. So didn't like that. I loved how they were able to deal with all the different nuances the Niners threw at them, all the different coverages. They had an answer for every different type of coverage they threw at them, and then kind of adapted in-game to what the Niners were doing. So good on Adam Gase for that, good on the offense for that. In the game, they ran 58 plays. 26 of those were runs, 32 of those were passes, if my math checks out, which it does, I believe. No, yes, it does. My math is not my strong suit, Kevin. I'm a bit of a writer, so not math. They had 3.7 yards per rush, 8.2 yards per pass play, and that includes the two sacks, so pretty good passing day. And then 5.2 yards per play on the day, 6 of 12 on third down. That got better as the game went on. And then a 91 and an 84-yard touchdown drive that is pretty spectacular.
Yeah, I can't even think of a game when we had two drives, let alone one, but two drives that long in a single game. Yeah, that was impressive.
Yeah, I remember when it used to be like if the Dolphins got the ball inside their own 10-yard line, it was like, okay, how many yards can we get before we punt to give our defense a chance to get a stop on the next drive? So
last year, if we got it there, it was how many plays before the other team got a safety.
I am so glad we haven't seen a safety this year. I think I've seen enough safeties for my lifetime with the Dolphins, so that's good to hear as well. Some individual stats for you now. Ryan Tannehill is 12th in the NFL in passer rating at 94.7. His 7.8 yards per attempt is 7th in the NFL. His 4.7 touchdown percentage is 15th in the NFL. And the INT percentage needs to come down a little bit, but it is getting lower. It's at 2.4%, which is 22nd in the NFL. So he's pretty efficient in the yard department, right in the middle in touchdowns, and then kind of top 22 in interceptions. So needs to cut that down a little bit. But that's probably more of a function of not as many throws in this offense, so understandable there. But he has been efficient.
The beginning of the season.
Yeah. Multiple pick games will do that to you, so kind of rough there. As for the offense as a whole, they are 9th in yards per play at 5.8, but they're 26th in yards per game. So efficient, but not volume. And same thing in passing, 7.8 yards per game or per pass is 8th in the league, but they're 28th in yards per game at 216 per game. And then they are 4th in yards per rush at 4.7 and 6th in yards per game at 116. So rushing the ball is still a strong point for this team. And then points, we are 17th in the league in points per game at 22.6 points per game. So offense is picking that up a little bit. On the day, Jarvis Landry got 55 snaps. Devontae Parker only had 37 because he got injured, so he came out. And Lante Carew picked up 11 snaps. Kenny Stills had 51 of the 58. And Jakeem Grant had 2, so he got on the field for a couple of snaps. Deion Sims, 58 snaps, all 58 of them. Marquise Gray, 14. Dominic Jones, 4. Jay Ajayi had 47 plays. Damian Williams had 11. Kenyon Drake with 3. And then Tannehill and the entire offensive line had 58. So Deion Sims appears to be the guy they're going to go with, that tight end for the foreseeable future. And then the top three receivers, Parker, Landry, and Stills, are going to be the ones that see the receiver duties. So I thought the offense was the more impressive side on Sunday, personally, than the defense. But it was the defense that made the winning play on Colin Kaepernick, folding up like a lawn chair. And Kevin, unless you have any final notes on the offense, I'm going to punt it back over to you for the defense.
I like that. my only note was I think with Carew's touchdown, now all three of the skill position players we've drafted in this year have scored a touchdown. Drake had the kickoff return against the Jets. Grant had the punt return against the Titans. Now Carew has one. So
yeah, and not saying it's a really high mark, but this is by far the best rookie contribution we've had in quite some time. So it's good to see that.
Yeah. And I forgot Drake had the rushing touchdown way back in Week 2 against the Patriots.
Yeah.
So taking over on defense. Obviously, it wasn't the greatest day. It looked like they were going to kind of get out of that game with like a 38-14 win or something like that, and then that fourth quarter happened. Not a good day for the run defense. They gave up 193 yards. 113 of that was from Colin Kaepernick on scrambles and zone reads. But going back to the theme we had from a couple weeks ago, those big runs, here's just an interesting thing, maybe only to me, but Carlos Hyde and DeJuan Harris combined for 80 yards on 15 carries. It's 5.3 yards per carry, but Hyde had that 124-yard run. If you take that out, the yards per carry average drops to 4 even, and then Hyde on the day goes 12 for 41. So I think they did a nice job of bottling those two guys up, but Kaepernick basically thrashed them, you know, with the scrambles, and he made Jelani Jenkins look bad, the zone read plays. I think it's not just a Cameron Wake thing. It's a defensive end thing. Miami's teaching their ends to come down hard and relying on linebackers like Jelani Jenkins to take on the quarterback. That's a mistake, and I think that's going to be something that maybe Buffalo with Tyrod Taylor will exploit when we see them again. You know, and then just for fun, I went back and I looked up sort of the running quarterbacks to see how we've fared against them. Russell Wilson only had 16 yards on 4 carries, so I think we did a nice job against him. Marcus Mariota had 7 for 60, including a 21-yard run, so not a good day. Tyrod Taylor had 7 for 35, but I think at least 3 of those carries were on the final drive of the game when Miami pretty much had it locked up. And then Kaepernick just shredded us with 10 for 113 on Sunday.
Yeah, sorry to cut you off here, Kevin. I mean, I definitely appreciate that point. But, I mean, it does seem to be a problem. It has been in the past, at least, you know, before this year, especially last year, I felt like. And I was going to ask you, you know, what can they do to mitigate that in the future? Because it does seem like they struggle with those running quarterbacks, you know, quite often.
Yeah, I think some of it, at least on Sunday, was Miami just trying not to get beat by the big play. I think, you know, too, though, sometimes when you see it, those guys are trying to stay in their pass rush lanes. And if you go all the way back to our very first podcast when we talked about the wide nine origins and Jim Washburn coming up with that chart of, you know, spots to rush to, I think you kind of saw a couple opportunities where Wake and Sue were beating the offensive lineman, blocking them so much that they kind of went in and went after Kaepernick. And just that little split second gave him enough time to run out of there and, you know, put all of Kaepernick's like political, you know, statements and commentary in a box and cast it aside. He's a hell of an athlete. So just giving him those little windows gave him plenty of time to kind of rush. And, you know, I wrote, he juked Kiko Alonso one time in a one-on-one situation. He juked Jelani Jenkins several times throughout the day, or just flat out was too fast for him. I think moving forward, I think as long as Miami is a little more disciplined, and I think having Mario Williams back fully healthy and Jason Jones off suspension for that Buffalo game will discipline with it. You know, hopefully that'll kind of limit things once we see Tyrod Taylor again. But fortunately, I think just looking at the schedule, he's really the only mobile guy we're going to see the rest of the way. So that's a nice break for Miami. You know, Kiko Alonso, I thought he had a pretty good game. There's some plays where he's bad. Obviously, the touchdown pass to Hyde on the opening drive. You know, he bit a little too quick on the play fake and undercut the play instead of trying to fight over the top of the pick. So that was, you know, something that I didn't really like. I thought Donald Butler kind of had another down game. He always seems to be around but he's always like the guy who they're running at when the other teams are breaking off these big runs. You know, he, instead of wrong-arming it, he tried to go head-on with a guard and got himself out of position on Hyde's 24-yard run. You still see Kiko Alonso kind of struggling. So, you know, there's just kind of a combination of bad plays. But I do think that in this game, Miami tried to play the run sort of like they did against Pittsburgh and Le'Veon Bell. Just because San Francisco runs so many of these, you know, misdirection plays or these little split-belly plays off of a zone read look, I think Miami kind of coached their linebackers to stay back, don't attack your gap until you know who has the ball. So I think they were willing to give up 4 and 5 yard runs in order to try and prevent the long runs by Hyde and DeJuan Harris. And they did a pretty good job of that other than the one play. Obviously, Kaepernick kind of shredded them elsewhere. But, you know, that's something I think will Miami will have to, you know, basically just kind of ride out the season with until they can restock the talent at linebacker.
Yeah, it's something that I kind of looked at too. And I only got a chance to watch the Dolphins defense on the broadcast version, which I think is kind of, you know, not doing it justice because you can't really see the whole field. But I thought Kiko Alonso was constantly in the wrong hole on some of those big plays, as you mentioned. And I just was curious. It seems like he pulls this trigger early often. Like, he makes his decision and he goes. Is that a function of the defense? Is that something he can show more discipline on? Or am I just completely wrong on that? Don't know what the hell I'm talking about, or what's going on with that?
I think it's a function of the defense, and I think it's a function of his skill set as a player, because, you know, he's not big enough to take on centers and guards head on and stack and shed them and rip underneath and get into his gap. He's going to have to run around him. And I think sometimes he tries to do that so quickly, it kind of creates a lane for a cutback. You know, I was thinking about that, you know, today, just kind of rewatching some of the film. I really think the best answer for Miami is going to be to draft just a hammer at middle linebacker, whether it's Anthony Walker, Reuben Foster, you know, Kendall Beckwith. They need someone big who can play in the middle and take on those guys head on and move Kiko Alonso to weak side next year, to kind of let him use his speed and athleticism a little more. So I think that's really the kind of function of it. He doesn't have that, you know, to use a golf analogy, he doesn't have that shot in his bag. And the way the defense is structured, you need someone who does have that ability. So I think that's where he kind of lost it there. The other notes I had against the run, I thought Ndamukong Suh and Jordan Phillips both had great games. They both played pretty well against double teams. You know, they had some pretty odd looks sometimes against the run game. San Francisco one time had it to where Kiko Alonso was basically playing slot corner and Issa Abdul-Kaddous was playing linebacker. Not really sure what was going on there. I noticed for the first time they really played some exaggerated overfronts. So it actually did kind of look like our defense last year once Louie Anarumo took over. That may have been more just a product of trying to stop some of those zone reads, just playing wider across the front. You know, I think Vance Joseph didn't have his best day at the office, but, you know, it was just an interesting way to see him go about it. Cause I think other than stopping Kaepernick, Miami was almost right on the money stopping Hyde and Harris. You know, and I know I kind of talked with Chris from the Perfectville podcast on Twitter, about it during the game, but, you know, I kind of agreed. I thought Vance Joseph kind of outsmarted himself with that. You know, I know you had kind of mentioned that before we started recording. If you go into some of those pass rushes and exotic packages, you know, we did a lot of different stuff that we hadn't done. You know, we had some half radar looks with the two D tackles, or at least Sue and Andre Branch standing up in the middle. They had one play where they had Sue line up at DN and Wake at D tackle and did a loop around him. They lined up with no spy on Kaepernick's 30-yard scramble. Jordan Phillips got doubled and forced inside, which created the seam for that, and no one was waiting for him. Like I talked about with the zone reads earlier, you know, Miami's teaching their defensive ends to crash down hard, and when you have Jelani Jenkins and Donald Butler as your outside linebackers, it's just not a good matchup one-on-one versus a running quarterback like Kaepernick. You know, we saw a lot of double A-gap pressure looks, which was an old staple of the Cincinnati defense. You know, but in terms of pure pass rushing, Cameron Wake kept his streak alive. He's had a sack, at least one sack in every one of the six games on the win streak. And Andre Branch got another one, so he's up to 4.5 on the year. I thought Miami had a lot of pressure on Kaepernick, but they weren't able to get home. And I think if they're able to play like that against Baltimore, they should be able to get Flacco pretty roughed up.
Yeah, I think you're spot on with that. Now, I kind of had a comment here for you asking about if Vance Joseph had kind of outsmarted himself there, but it seemed like he did, and they kind of probably had more exotic looks than they needed to because of the unique style of Chip Kelly and Colin Kaepernick. But the next question I had for you was, you know, I didn't really get a chance to see much of Jordan Phillips and Earl Mitchell. I think they kind of got washed away in the kind of the hype of the Chip Kelly offense and kind of making – the second level defend them in certain ways. So I kind of didn't watch them as much. I found it difficult to scout them. So did you see the same thing, or were those complex run schemes kind of keeping them off balance, or what did you get from those two guys?
You know, regardless of who was in at defensive tackle, because Miami actually played Nick Williams a few snaps there. So whether it was Sue Phillips Mitchell or Nick Williams, San Francisco pretty much tried to double team both defensive tackles on pretty much every run play. I thought Sue, you know, he's used to it. I thought Phillips did a really good job. He didn't lose ground the way he, you know, was earlier in the season, or especially last year. He kind of just fought, stalemated his guys, you know, almost split one of them. It's tough to do in that wide nine just because you're, you know, the way San Francisco sets up their offense. And I think it kind of speaks to some of the genius behind Chip Kelly's run game is he basically was able to single block Wake and Branch with a tackle and a tight end. And he used the other tackle and guard and then the other guard and center to double team the two interior guys. And those guys were combo blocking off onto Alonzo and Butler and Jenkins, which made it kind of tough. So I thought they did well. I think Boomer on the Finns forum today said that Andy Benoit from Sports Illustrated did a lot of film review, and he was really high on Jordan Phillips. I agree. He's really becoming an ascending player, and I think he's really earned that starting role away from Earl Mitchell this year. Just to finish up with the pass defense, I thought we saw a lot of two-man and obvious passing situations, and Chip Kelly, I think, kind of took advantage of Miami's linebackers, especially Jelani Jenkins. You know, I thought Maxwell and Lippitt were solid. Maxwell had a huge play on the second-to-last play of the game to make that pass break up on the slant pattern there. I thought Bobby McCain had, you know, maybe his best game of the season. I think the one play that he did give up was that crossing route to Rod Streeter. Jelani Jenkins didn't get a reroute on him coming across, so you know, hard to really say who that's on. But I thought he had a good game. You know, he made a great play blowing up the screen pass in the third quarter to Streeter. That was really impressive. He fought off the block, lost his helmet, and still made the tackle. Neville Hewitt, I thought, had a down game. You know, Miami kind of got linebackers caught in space in some man-under situations. And one of the notes I had was they need a dime linebacker because right now, you know, when they go dime, they don't have that fourth corner or third safety that can come down in the box and play it. That would have been a perfect role for Rashad Jones, especially with Bakari Rambo now. But I think Chip Kelly just kind of identified Jelani Jenkins and put a sombrero on him and made him look bad pretty much all game. And something tells me that if that Week 17 matchup against New England is meaningful, Brady and Belichick and Gronk will probably do the same thing to Jelani. That said, though, if you include the sacks and all passing plays, Miami only gave up 5.9 yards per passing play, you know, which I thought was pretty impressive. The other note I had was Neville Hewitt. You know, he got a few more coverage snaps and some base looks this week. He struggled. He gave up the touchdown to Brent Celek on the crossing route where Kiko Alonso was spying Kaepernick. That's just kind of a thing with Neville Hewitt. He's pretty good against the run. But subpar in the pass game. So, you know, those were kind of my overall thoughts. You know, did you have any thoughts on the pass defense or run defense from Sunday?
Yeah. I thought Bobby McCain did have his best game or, you know, played his best game of the year, as you mentioned. And I saw some comments on thefins.com about how he had a bad game. I think they probably took that missed tackle that you mentioned from the Rod Streeter crossing route. And yeah, that was Jelani Jenkins probably missing a reroute there. So didn't really understand that very much. But I did have a question for you about the linebackers. You mentioned Reuben Foster and Anthony Walker earlier. I was curious because we have, you know, Hewitt, Alonzo, Butler, and Jenkins are all on this team getting significant snaps right now. And I was curious what you think those four guys' long-term fits are on this roster. And do we need one linebacker, two linebackers, three? How many new ones do we need?
Yeah, so I'm operating under the assumption that Cole Meese's probably not going to be back just because of all the injuries he suffered.
I forgot about him, honestly.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've done all this without him. I don't see a reason to keep him, especially with a higher salary. My thought on it is, absolutely, you keep Kiko Alonso at this point, whether you play him in the middle or the weak side. I think it's kind of a determination you make next year after the free agency and period and the draft, you know, happens. But I think you absolutely keep him. You know, he's been tremendous. What's he got? You know, two interceptions, one of them a pick six, and I think two forced fumbles in the last three games. So, I mean, that's – we haven't had that in a long time. I think he's got, what, like 91 tackles now. So I think you keep him. I would keep Neville Hewitt as just sort of that fourth linebacker. I would absolutely get rid of Jelani Jenkins. There's no reason to keep him. Donald Butler, I would be okay with bringing him back on like a team-friendly deal, just knowing he's going to be that 15 to 25 snap per game Sam backer, but that's really it. The rest of the guys we have, Hull, Vigil, if you re-sign Paysinger, I think those guys are more core special teams guys. So I would say Miami needs, you know, two linebackers. You need someone who can play in the middle, in my opinion. And then I think it may just be cheaper to get, you know, a Sam linebacker who can replace Butler, unless he comes back on a really team-friendly deal. Just finishing up my defensive notes here. Overall, you know, like I said, I thought Vance Joseph kind of outthought himself today. That third down play on San Francisco's field goal drive, the second to last drive of the game, they had that third and long, and he ran a zone blitz with Cameron Wake dropping into coverage. That just shouldn't ever happen, in my opinion. We got to see way more of Terrence Fidday and Nick Williams than we ever should see in that game. And Nick Williams was pretty bad, other than the goal line snaps he took at D tackle. I thought Ndamukong Suh he had a great game. On the day, the defense had two sacks, one forced fumble and recovery with Alonzo, and then Alonzo's interception. They also had three tackles for loss in the game. And credit to Suh for that hustle play. Third down defense took a big dive this week, although I think Miami still tops in the NFL. But San Francisco got 7 out of 14, and they were also 2 of 2 on fourth down conversions. Just kind of interesting to me, out of the 78 defensive snaps we played, Kiko Alonso played all 78. I think he's played every snap in every game on this streak, except for missing two in the Buffalo game, which I think is pretty impressive. Suh had another big game, played 67. Branch played 69. Wake played 51. Just if Miami's able to kind of cut down on those plays, and I think they really kind of stacked up in that fourth quarter when the offense had the back-to-back three and outs. So I think eliminating that kind of eliminates, you know, a good chunk of San Francisco's yardage and stats that they had in that game. So that's my thoughts on the defense. Anything you wanted to add to that?
No, man, that's pretty much the top-level type of defensive film breakdown we get from you every week here. Kevin Dern, our defensive coordinator of Perfectville. And, when you're not watching the defense, Kevin, I think maybe you're moonlighting as a special teams coordinator. Is that kind of your second gig there? I just wanted to ask you, give us a quick thought on the special teams from Sunday.
I thought they were much better in terms of covering kicks and punts. Really, the only miss there was the one that kind of went between Bobby McCain and Tony Lippett that they couldn't down inside the 10. Kenny and Drake obviously had a big return. I think he had a 78-yard return. I think teams are clearly kicking away from Jakeem Grant just because they're worried about him. But he did have another muff on a punt return. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Jarvis Landry was the punt returner for every punt after that. So I kind of feel like Jakeem Grant may have a confidence problem. And, you know, I hope he gets a chance to break one on a kickoff sometime soon. But I think I did see he was like in the top 10 in the league still in kickoff returns. So that was kind of impressive to me. But otherwise, a good day. They're going to need it this week because Justin Tucker is a maniac at kicking field goals.
Yeah, he's ridiculous.
So we'll see about that. But I think that kind of takes us into our next segment, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I just quick on Jakeem Grant. Like you said, it's got to be a confidence issue. And I don't know if he's going to get another chance to pop one because he's losing that job right now with Kenyon Drake looking so good and Jarvis Landry being the kind of sure hands back there. So it is, but it is a win regardless of the muff punt, regardless of the defensive collapse there, regardless of the offense getting conservative. And that makes me want to talk a little bit about some playoffs, Kevin.
Sounds good.
Well, they're talking about winning games. We're talking about winning six straight games. We're talking about playing January football and not the New Year's Day game against the Patriots. We have that on the schedule. We know that's going to be a game. But we do have currently the sixth seed in the AFC right now, and we actually have the fourth best record in the AFC. If it wasn't for the division alignment, we'd be sitting really pretty at 7-4 right now, with the Chiefs at 8-3 directly ahead of us in the fifth seed, and then the Broncos the same record and trailing us by a half game in conference record. The Dolphins are 5-3 in the AFC. The Broncos are 4-3 in the AFC. So that's where where we have them on the tiebreaker right now for the sixth seed in the playoffs. Kevin, are the Broncos the biggest threat right now to take that spot from us?
Yeah, I would say so. Or the other scenario that could come up is if we lose to Baltimore on Sunday and somehow Pittsburgh is able to overtake Baltimore for the lead in the AFC North because they do play on Christmas Day, that could come back to bite us in the end as far as a tiebreaker goes. But yeah, I think Miami's got to stay ahead of Denver, and then I still worry about Tennessee. They have a bye this week. Maybe they get hot over their last four, and if they can't catch Houston, they have the tiebreaker on us. So I really think it's this game. And, you know, I thought it was kind of ironic we're playing Baltimore this weekend. If the playoffs had started, that's who we would be playing at Baltimore. So I really think the Ravens, the Broncos, and the Titans are the three teams we kind of need to continue to lose.
Yeah, you know, I've been watching the Ravens a lot this year, and as I do most every team, but just something about them, they don't really seem that scary to me. And we'll get to them in the preview for next week a little bit later, but they just don't worry me that much. I think the Steelers game will go heavily in favor of the Steelers because they'll have, you know, knock on wood for Ben there, but they should have a healthy Ben Roethlisberger back for that game. They didn't have it the first time, so we'll see about that. If the Ravens lose to us, then they got a tough road to hoe from there and getting the AFC North title. I think it's, you know, the Broncos offense right now, there's no running game there. Trevor Siemian is, you know, he's not made for this league, I don't think. He plays okay at times, but just doesn't have the arm talent or the overall talent to make it happen as an NFL quarterback. So yeah, I think that right now it's the loser of the AFC North probably we got to worry about. And then Buffalo kind of worries me a little bit. You know, they have a pretty easy road after these next two games. Buffalo goes at Oakland and then home for Pittsburgh. If they can get one of those wins and get themselves to, let's see, they'd be 7-6. They host Cleveland, they host us, and they play at the Jets. And I think if they can get one of those two wins and then beat us, they're probably going to be the 10-6 AFC sixth seed. So they're, you know, that week 16 game just comes down to basically everything, I think, is what it will end up being in the end. But right now, yeah, I'd probably have to stick with Pittsburgh and Denver and Baltimore being the ones we're most worried about since they're nipping at our heels there. So that's our playoffs preview there, looking forward. Next, I wanted to get into another new segment we've been working on here a little bit at the Finalysis podcast, and that would be the member berries. So if you remember South Park, you remember the show at all, we've been doing these member berries segment where we pop a couple member berries and think back to some former Dolphins players that we, you know, loved growing up and or whatever it was in Dolphins past. For me, I went back to a guy that if you've been on any of the Finn Heaven or the Finn's message boards over the past decade and you've seen me on there under Aqua Forever 04, you will know that this was my man crush for a long, long time and still is, him and Ricky Williams.
Huge man crush.
Massive man crush. I kind of had a thing for receivers. I still do. They're my favorite players on the field most times. But Chris Chambers and his 5'11 frame, the way he high-pointed the football over DBs that were bigger than him. I kind of thought about Devontae Parker going up for some of those balls and you know, laying out for some of those passes on Sunday. And they reminded me of Chris Chambers with his vertical downfield threat and his ability to high-point the ball.
Yeah, and mine, and I'm proud to say I actually stumped you because you didn't know this player when I texted you earlier this afternoon about him, is actually Michael Stewart. He was a strong safety for the Dolphins way back in the mid-90s. And the reason I brought him up today is actually one specific play. It's going back to the wild card round. Miami hosted Kansas City in 94. That was Marino's revenge against Joe Montana in the playoffs. Miami was ahead 27-17 in the fourth quarter. Kansas City was starting to drive, try and get back into the game. And Marcus Allen had the ball running down the sidelines. And Michael Stewart just kind of came over there, could have just absolutely laid him out and somehow stopped and basically just ripped the ball away from Marcus Allen right there and basically ended the Chiefs' threat right there. Miami went on to win the game. I won't talk about what happened the next round against San Diego, but yeah. The reason I brought that up is because of Byron Maxwell. I think he's done it a few times, and maybe this is something he just picked up in Seattle, but he's kind of got a knack for not only knocking the ball away in pass coverage, but when he's wrapped up with a ball carrier, he's popped the ball out two or three times now this year, and I think it was actually him who popped the ball out on the fumble recovery that Kiko Alonso recovered in the first half. And that kind of ended a 49ers scoring drive when they could have gotten up, I believe, 14-7 at the time on Miami, and that could have made it a different ball game. So Michael Stewart, for that play in the 94 wild card game against the Chiefs, gets my member berry for today.
Yeah, that was Byron Maxwell punching that ball out. And you got to remember, Kevin, I was 6 years old, 94, so or no, 7 years old, so give me a little bit of a break on Michael Stewart there. Although I will say that Stojanovic miss game against the Chargers was my first real member or my memory of the Dolphins playing, so I guess I wasn't too young to remember that. Moving on from the member berries here, a couple of quick housekeeping notes, if you don't mind getting to some roster notes for us here, Kevin.
Yeah, so it's all practice squad this week other than a couple guys who were active on game day. Jake Brendel was active on game day for Miami. I think he got one play and a goal line set. And then Nick Williams, who we've had on the roster for several weeks now, finally got active. Wasn't too impressed, but he got the nod over Leon Orr for whatever reason on Sunday. Practice squad notes, B'nai Benwickery is actually gone. I checked NFL.com. They actually keep a pretty good transaction list. It doesn't look like he was ever on the practice squad, so I take back what I said last week when I saw on Twitter that he was on there. He is not. He is gone. Miami has added two players to the practice squad since they called up a couple guys in the wake of Jason Jones' suspension. That would be tight end Brett Brackett. If you remember that name, he was actually an undrafted free agent for Miami in 2011 and then came back and went into preseason camp with us in 2014. He played 7 games for the Titans that year, but that's really been it over his NFL career. And then we also added tackle Jesse Davis to the practice squad out of the University of Idaho. Don't know if either of those guys are really going to amount to anything more than practice squad players at this point.
University of Idaho, that's probably my neck of the woods out here. That's interesting. We'll give you a pass on B'nai Benwickery. I was hoping he would make an impact on this roster. I liked his play for the Panthers a couple of years back, but he is no longer with us. He still is living, not with the Dolphins, though, is what I meant to say. So that brings us to our next point we wanted to get to. And I thought this was kind of an interesting point in kind of looking at his production over the last couple of years. And on Sunday, it wasn't a great production, but what he means to this team. And Jarvis Landry is due a new contract in 2 years. And I was curious to see what you thought about, you know, what he might get, what we should give him, when they should extend him, should they extend him, and what he might be looking at. I'm going to pull up some of the other receivers that have gotten new contracts, like, you know, the Tavon Austins and those guys of the world, and kind of look at that if you want to expand on what you think about Jarvis Landry's contract here for a minute, Kevin.
Yeah, so I think if I've got the rule right, we are not allowed to talk an extension with him until his third league year is complete, which would be this season, but the NFL league year ends in like, it's either March 1st or March 10th, something like that. So we can't even talk to Jarvis Landry until next spring about an extension. Do I think Miami should? Absolutely. As far as like what I would want to do, I really didn't look up many other receivers and see what kind of deals they got, but I think if you can keep that guy around for another 4 or 5 year deal and kind of basically get him in line with Tannehill for Tannehill's, you know, prime years of his career. I always kind of think quarterbacks tend to do better, you know, 28, 29, 30, 30, you know, up to 32, 33, in most cases, other than Tom Brady, that is. So I think if you can keep Landry around, that's basically giving him a security blanket. It's giving you a sure-handed receiver, someone who's going to make all those catches. So I would absolutely do it, and I would even overpay to do it just because I think he brings you some intangible stuff in terms of leadership. So that's my take on it. I say absolutely keep the juice in Miami.
Yeah, I'm with you on keeping him all the way. I'm looking here at some of the top paid receivers in the league, and you know the reason I wanted to bring this conversation up was because of the production. And you know he's not a big yards guy. He's only got 2 touchdowns in the year. So if he wants to come to the table and ask for, you know, AJ Green or Alshon Jeffrey type money, the guys at the top of the list here, which Alshon Jeffrey probably doesn't really belong there, but he is. But some of these guys with these big contracts, you know, Julio Jones, Demaryius Thomas, Dez Bryant, T.Y. Hilton. Doug Baldwin just got a big deal. I think that might be a good starting point because Jarvis Landry kind of provides a lot of the spark and also some of the production as well. Not quite as much as Doug Baldwin does.
What are the numbers on Baldwin's deal?
Baldwin got a 46 total million or 46 million in total, 11.5 average per year, 12 million guaranteed. And then he's a free agent in 2021. So that's a pretty good base
deal.
Yeah. Yeah. Looks like it. And then Allen Hurns and Tavon Austin both got new deals this year. Tavon Austin's is worth $42 million. averages $10 million a year, so a four-year deal with 17 guaranteed. I think that's a really good number because Landry's far better than Austin, but that's kind of the neighborhood we're looking at because it's not that elite money, but I think he should be getting something in that range. So think Tavon Austin, Allen Hurns, Doug Baldwin type of money for the production he's given you. And you got, you know, other guys on that list that don't belong and some guys that do belong. They're lower, like Antonio Brown's way down the list, for instance. So, I mean, yeah, it's kind of a mixed match and that kind of changes every year, but absolutely bring Jarvis Landry back. Like you said, you got to have Ryan Tannehill's best friend there with him to moving forward. So definitely bring him back. I'll be really curious to see what they get for him or give to him, I should say. And yeah, just an interesting conversation because they can't talk to him until next year. But I hope it gets done before the year ends. We don't want to see another mass exodus with Lamar Miller, Olivier Vernon, and Rishard Matthews all leaving in free agency again. So get those guys signed up, get them back, keep those guys in house as long as we can. All right, Kevin. So let's move on here. So our second to last segment, and that's going to be previewing the Baltimore Ravens game. I had a chance to look over them on Game Pass the last couple of days and watch a few of them. I saw them lose to the Jets, watched most of that game as well. So I have a pretty good idea for their offense, but I'm going to kick it over to you for their defense to start with.
Yeah, sounds good. So with the Ravens, it's kind of going to be more of the same. We've seen a big run of 3-4 teams in this win streak. You know, the Jets, the Bills, the Steelers, San Diego, San Francisco, all around the 3-4. So Miami's really the only team that we haven't seen that plays that defense is the Rams. So it's going to be something, you know, pretty similar to that. That said, the Ravens have just some absolute hogs up front. Brandon Williams at nose tackle goes 6'1", about 350. They also have Lawrence Guy. He kind of caught my eye. Timmy Jernigan's a really good player out of Florida State. They have some massive players on the edge with Terrell Suggs, otherwise known as Darth Sizzle. I think everyone kind of knows about him. You have Albert McClellan, who's their Sam backer. He's played really well, and I think he's an undrafted guy. He's really kind of grown into that role. Elvis Dumervil is a pass rush specialist they have. Matthew Judon out of Grand Valley State has really played well this year. They're all big, physical, strong guys that can set the edge. Pretty straightforward in terms of the 3-4. They'll play that one gapping scheme, pretty similar to what San Francisco did. They do a lot of confusing stuff on third downs. They'll play a lot of those radar formation looks. They'll do some interesting things with Eric Weddle, where they'll keep him in a two shell, or they'll roll him back into a single high look. They'll roll him back pre-snap. They'll roll him back at the snap. But for whatever reason, I feel like Miami's always kind of messed around with Eric Weddle and never really gotten burned in the few games we played against him in San Diego. And even last year when we beat the Ravens, they do have the number one run defense in the NFL. They're giving up just 74.9 yards a game. They're fourth in points allowed at just over 18. They're second in total defense, giving up under 300 yards a game. So I think it's going to be a challenge for Miami to move the ball, especially against the run. I watched the Jets game and the Bengals game. Really the only types of success that the Bengals had, especially this past weekend, were just kind of running some of those split belly plays up the middle, maybe some inside zone with a Jaya work, or some of those little split belly counters that we've run a few times will work. But I think Miami's going to be in a lot of trouble if they try and rush on the edge against these guys. Unless, of course, Albert and Tunsil are back, I think that may help. In terms of sacks, they are 10th in the NFL with 26, which is one more than the Dolphins' 25. They have forced 19 turnovers. 11 of those are interceptions, which is tied for fourth in the league, and they have forced 10 fumbles. So I think Miami's got to do a great job of protecting the football. Their third down defense is excellent. They're second in the league after the Dolphins, just a few percentage points behind them. They're giving up 33.5% conversion rate against the run. I just think it's going to be a tough defense to move the ball on. But really, the one guy I think that you can kind of pick on, especially if Devontae Parker plays, is Sharice Wright, their left corner. I think that's who Miami need to target. So, Travis, your thoughts on their offense?
Yeah, that sounds good from their defense, man. I think the defense is going to be tough to move the ball on. But like you said, we've got to protect the football, and we've been doing that a lot over the last six weeks. So I think they'll be able to take care of that. And I think the offense will have success against that defense because of short fields and because They've been improving in the red zone over the last few weeks. And the reason I say short fields is because this Ravens offense, man, it's kind of hard to watch. It kind of reminds me of some of those old Dolphins offenses that just kind of get stuck in the mud and don't really do a whole lot. And they punt the football a lot, and they rely a lot on Justin Tucker for long field goals. They run a similar heavy offense to what we do. They had 68 snaps on their last game against the Bengals, 41 for Dennis Pitta, 20 for Darren Waller, and 11 for Nick Boyle. So those three tight ends are getting a lot of snaps, a lot of reps, a lot of heavy sets, and they run a lot of play action off that. They will take the underneath stuff all game and just kind of lull you to sleep before they hit you with a couple of deep shots to either Brashad Perriman or Mike Wallace, you know, 4 to 6 times per game. But both those guys are kind of, I don't want to say one-trick pony for Perriman, but Wallace certainly is. He either runs those little drag routes or goes deep for the most part. And then Brashad Perriman, he's kind of, you know, hasn't really carved out his, you know, route running niche yet because he just kind of runs some posts and corners and skinny posts and seam routes and that kind of thing. So not really much from him so far. He's made some big plays, but that's about it. The run blocking has been suspect at times, especially in the interior. Marshall Yanda is still one of the best in the game. But Ronnie Stanley is a great at protecting Joe Flacco's blind side at left tackle, but he's not really a mauler in the run game like you'd like. The runtime has a hard time getting going, obviously. If you stop them and force them to third and long, you'll absolutely kill them. I mean, Joe Flacco, he had that great run a couple of years back to win the Super Bowl, but he looks like he just doesn't give a damn to me. Like, he's just back to kind of being, you know, ho-hum. He's reluctant to move from his spot unless it's by design where they play action boot him. He stares guys down. He's quick to take the easy route rather than staring down the gun barrel by just kind of, you know, he'll leak out or he'll throw it somewhere quickly rather than standing there and take the hit and deliver a good shot. I think Kamari Aiken's a guy to watch for working inside against Bobby McCain. He's kind of got that lean, tall build that can give McCain some problems up the seam and whatnot, because Aiken's kind of their, like, their wild card, their ace in the hole, if you will, and they kind of go to him on some big plays, and he actually makes some good plays for them. I would be remiss if I didn't mention Steve Smith. I didn't write much down about him, but I think he's just kind of one of those fiery competitors that can get in your head. Hopefully he doesn't really get in Byron Maxwell's head like Brandon Marshall did a few weeks back. Their offense is 25th in the league with 19.8 points per game. They only average 3.6 yards per carry, which is 29th in the league, and 88 yards per game, which is 28th in the league. So the run offense is just dreadful, which really plays well for the Dolphins, I think. And then 6.4 yards per pass is 30th in the NFL. Only Jacksonville and Houston are worse passing offenses on a yards per play basis, and their 246 yards per game is 18th in the NFL. They've allowed 23 sacks. That is 20th worst in the NFL. And their 10 interceptions they've thrown is 11th worst. Joe Flacco, listen to these numbers for Joe Flacco. His touchdown percentage is 2.4. That's dead last among qualifying starting quarterbacks. So 32nd for Joe Flacco. His 2.2 interception percentage is 20th in the NFL, right where Ryan Tannehill is with throwing interceptions. And his 6.4 yards per pass, like I mentioned, is 30th, you know, behind only ahead of Jacksonville and Houston. So I think it's time for this defense to feast. I think they will. I think they'll keep them in short fields. I think they will make them punt from deep at their own end. I think the Dolphins offense will capitalize on that field position. I think special teams, I think three takeaways for the defense from this offense, from the Ravens' really bad offense. And I think the Dolphins are getting a little bit sick of all this talk about, well, you haven't beaten anybody, and well, you're not the Patriots. The division's the Patriots, and you guys are just kind of making a cute little run here, and you'll get knocked off by the Broncos and these other superior teams. I think they've heard enough of that shit. I think they're going to come out and take the ball away and be efficient on third downs in the red zone. And I think they're going to put a beating on the Ravens in Baltimore. I think it's going to be 30-12 with Justin Tucker kicking 4 field goals and the Ravens don't see the end zone on Sunday.
Ooh, bold. I like it.
Why not?
Yeah. So the Ravens, to me, they're just kind of one of those teams that have always kind of had Miami's number up until last year with the Danimal Dan Campbell basically breaking us through that losing streak against them. I also predicted a score with Tucker hitting 4 field goals, but I'm going to go 21-19 Miami with Tucker finally missing to lose the game at the end.
That's perfect.
So I say 21-19.
There you go. So both of us think the Dolphins are going to go to 8-4 and really get themselves in nice position for a playoff run with the the kind of struggling Cardinals right now and the Jets to follow after that. But let's get this one over the Ravens, and then we'll really be looking at playoffs from there. And the last segment we have for you guys tonight, which we always do, is Kevin and I like to talk about a draft prospect that we have taken a liking to. And I'm really excited to talk about mine tonight. But I'll kick it over to you, Kevin, first for your defensive player you're looking at.
First, I'm going to go back to a couple weeks when I said Taco Charlton. Just pop in the Ohio State Michigan game and watch him and tell me you don't want him.
He was a stud.
Yeah. I'm actually going to go with another Big Ten defensive end tonight, but this guy is coming from a very sad Illinois team. His name is Dwayne Smoot. Big guy, about 6'3", 255, 260 pounds. Kind of got lost on that bad Illinois team, as some of those players are kind of going to do. But he's had some really eye-popping games in terms of stat production. He's got 1, 2, 3 games with 8 tackles on the season. He has 2 forced fumbles. He's got 5 sacks on the year. Just one of those guys, I feel like you could get him in the second or third round. He's long. He's lean. He has those long arms. You know, maybe if Miami goes with Travis's prospect or, another position in round 1, maybe you get Dwayne Smoot in round 2. So that's my guy to keep an eye on. Unfortunately, Illinois is not going bowling this year. They won 3 games, so you'll have to watch some highlights of him. You won't get to see him this coming December.
Now, my guy has 2 more games left under his – actually, probably 3 if you think about it, because he comes from Alabama, and they're probably not losing anytime soon. Definitely not on Saturday to the Florida Gators in the SEC championship game. And we've kind of talked about these core positions in the middle of the field, Kevin, a lot. I think that's kind of where this team will focus their efforts on. And I don't have the stats that you just threw out to kind of back up my argument here, because this guy's not really much of a stat whore this year as much as he is just making good football plays. And he is, of course, tight end O.J. Howard for the Alabama Crimson Tide. And the reason I talk about him as much as I do, I talked about Jake Butt a while back, but I think O.J. Howard, if this team wants to play Deion Sims every single snap, they might as well get the top shelf model at that position, and that is O.J. Howard, because this is a guy that understands leverage in the blocking game and how to get his hands in the right spot and kind of turn a guy and can really open up some huge holes off the outside. He'd be perfect for the zone running scheme. He'd be perfect for those peel back, misdirection play action boots to the tight end, and he can make guys miss in the open field when he has the football in his hands. He's a great red zone option. He can carry the ball. He can catch it. He can block. He can do just about everything. I think he would be the missing piece of this offense becoming a top 10 unit, and you can probably get him, I would like to think if we're picking in the 20 to 32 range, hopefully 32nd this year, I would like to think you can get him in that late first round. So I'm hoping that he might be the guy. I've really warmed on him lately. I'll probably change that pick about 7 times until April from now. But right now, O.J. Howard, tight end from Alabama, is my first round prospect that I really want to focus on moving forward. So that's going to do it for tonight's show, Kevin. You got anything else you wanted to add?
Let's go for 7 on Sunday. Let's beat the Ravens.
Beat the Ravens, get 7, move to 8-4. First 7-game winning streak since 1985 when the Dolphins lost to the Patriots in the AFC Championship game. Hopefully we can reverse that fortune as well. Don't forget to check out the Perfectville podcast with Sam and Chris. They put a show out on Monday, I believe it was, or maybe it was Tuesday. That's up on iTunes right now and on the WelcomeToPerfectville.com website. They'll have another episode for you guys previewing the Ravens game coming out either Thursday or Friday. So don't forget to check that out. Check out my blog portion of WelcomeToPerfectville.com with the Write Travis Wright tab there. You can find all my articles from the past, including an Adam Gase fluff piece I did way back in July talking about how great he was. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Give us a 5-star rating. We really appreciate that. And write us a nice review, too, because that's how we get our popularity up, and that's how we get more listeners and how we get to keep doing this. So really appreciate you guys listening to us tonight. And we're going to take off for now, but that's it from the Finalysis podcast. And we will see you guys next time.
Thanks for listening to the Finalysis with Travis Wingfield and Kevin Dern. Subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes. And go to WelcomeToPerfectField.com for the very best coverage of your Miami Dolphins. Fins up.